Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Daniel Landes discusses Parshat Maaseh. Rabbi Daniel Landes is the Rosh HaYeshiva and Director of Pardes. And now, Rabbi Daniel Landes.
Thank you, Larry. This week is the Parsha Maaseh, and this Parsha has whole touring information that takes place, as it were, when Bnei Yisrael, before they go into the Promised Land. And as one of the ways of preparing for the Promised Land, Moses is instructed by God to set aside cities which belong to the Levites. Levites, you know, do not have any rural area, only have urban centers. And in these urban centers and a few others, they are set asides for a certain group of people to dwell there besides for the Levites. So let's go to the verse that is chapter 35, verse 11. This is Bamidbar, Perek Lamed He, Pasuk Yud Aleph. V'kritam lachem arim, arim miklat, tiyena lachem, V'nas shama rotzeach maken nefesh bishkaga. V'kritam lachem arim, you shall provide yourselves with places, arim miklat, to serve you as cities of refuge, tiyena lachem, they should be for you. V'nas shama rotzeach maken nefesh, to which a manslayer who has killed a person unintentionally, bishkaga, he may flee there. So let me now read the English together. You shall provide yourselves with places to serve you as cities of refuge, to which a manslayer who has killed a person unintentionally may flee. The translation already uses the word rotzeach as manslayer, as manslaughter, as opposed to premeditated murder. Jewish law, bishkaga, unintentionally, which renders one as manslaughter, being the act that is performed, is under the general category of shkaga. You don't know that the act was wrong, is one possibility, but that doesn't really apply here. This is not like, for example, a Sabbath law. You just might not know that a certain Sabbath prohibition is in effect, and you just may, or you don't know about it, and you make a mistake and you do it. So that seems not to be the probable type of case when we're dealing with manslaughter. But the other one is in which you perform an act, and it leads to someone's death. You chopping wood, and the axe handle flies off, and it flies, and it hits someone. Or, for that matter, as you're in the backward motion, getting ready to build up some energy to then take it forward, and you hit a person with it. You didn't realize the person was behind you. That's manslaughter. In current contemporary cases, most traffic accidents, or I should say many, are really cases of manslaughter. You really didn't intend to do so. All sorts of subsidiary questions, whether or not you should have been drinking before or not, and how does that change things? But we have pure cases in which a car is going at even a proper speed, and someone darts out, and you hit someone, God forbid, and that's manslaughter. And the question is, how is this peculiar case taken with? And then we know about the cities of refuge. A person flees there, and once they're judged by the court to really be a case of shkaga, of manslaughter, they're judged that way. They flee there, and the reason they flee there is that the goel hadam, the blood avenger, should not reach them in time. It's a member of the family who is so incensed that he's ready to kill them. That gives an added incentive for the killer by mistake the manslayer for him to run to the city of refuge. Once the city of refuge, he can't be touched, and he remains there protected until the high priest dies. The Kohen Gadol dies. One never knows how long a high priest will stay in office, how long it'll be before he dies. And therefore, this is a uncertain period of time. It could be short, but it could be very long. And that's where he says, if he wanders out from the city of refuge, he's taking his life into his own hand, because the Goel Hadam, The Blood Avenger is free then to kill him, and that is how that mechanism works. What's the meaning of all this is becomes the task of the commentators. The commentators are trying to assess guilt and trying to assess what happens with that guilt. The major commentary that we have three commentators we want to look at, a major one from medieval times, and this is our one medievalist that we'll look at, is Rabbeinu Bachya, the great Spanish commentator who always had pardes, pshat, remez, drash, sod. He always had a plain meaning, and he always dealt with associative meanings, deep exegetical meanings, and mystical meanings. Here, I think he really has a philosophic explanation that he probably would say is pshat. I will read to you from his commentary, and I will paraphrase as I see it in the Hebrew. And the manslayer who slayed unintentionally, will run there. But he's not deserving of death because he did not slay intentionally, b'mezid. Mazed is intentionally. Because we know from logic, from investigation, that the heart is the seat of the human, is the most important part, it's the essential part of the human. And indeed, it's the heart that determines whether something is a mitzvah or something is an avera, whether something is a commandment or something is a transgression. And therefore, he is punished with a galut, with an exile, and not by death. And the emphasis here in the Rabbeinu Bachya is emphasized why is he not killed by the court, why is he not executed? Because his heart, he doesn't receive the death penalty because his heart did not agree to the slaughter, to the manslaying that took place. And therefore, there is only a death penalty for one who slays someone else when both the body and the heart together participate in that murder. Well, the body did it, and his body did it. There's no doubt about that. Everyone can say that they saw it. There may be witnesses who can attest to it. There has to be witnesses who attest to it in specificity, and indeed even the all participants who observed it or the one who perpetrated it are in agreement that he did it. The only thing is, he says, my heart wasn't in it. My heart refers to his heart, his mind. It really is a term here for consciousness. So what you need is both, in order for someone to be guilty, you need haguf betunuato, you need the body in its movement, and the heart, v'halei b'kavanato, the body in its movement and the heart with its intention. And since the two had not agreed, therefore he is, and I'll put in the word merely exiled, but he's not killed. He's not executed. And from this, the Rabbeinu Bachya takes us to a wider scope. And he says, this is true of all mitzvot. Everything is dependent upon the heart. Everything is dependent upon, as I'm translating, consciousness. That if a person does, in fact, turn it around, if a person does a mitzvah, not an avera, not a sin, not even this terrible sin, but if a person does a mitzvah, but he did not intend in his heart to do so, Bach goes further, he did not intend to do so l'shem shemaim, perhaps he intended to do it, but he didn't do it for the purpose of a heavenly purpose, a purpose of fulfilling the divine edict, a purpose, or one wants to even expand that to a purpose of doing something which is good. He just happened to do the act. He knows that he does the act, but he didn't have that signification of the heart connecting with deep meaning. And lo sechar mizeh, he receives no reward. For a person must intend in a mitzvah to do it l'shem shemaim. Now, we know this is a machloket, it's a disagreement in the Talmud, which continues in early authorities, that mitzvot tzrichot kavana or einan tzrichot kavana, do mitzvot need intention or not in order to have fulfilled it. So certain mitzvot, as pointed out by my teacher Rabbi Salvation, that certainly need intention, just by definition, like prayer. You just can't just utter words, it won't mean anything, or acceptance of the yoke of heaven, as we do so in the Shema. And there are could be others like that. But what if someone, for example, gives tzedakah, accidentally, or not say accidentally, casually. They do it for social pressure, do it for other reasons. Shem Shemaim would be a stretch, and maybe even beyond a stretch, to say so Shem Shemaim. Has it fulfilled the mitzvah? Some would say they have fulfilled the mitzvah, because what counts at the end is the act that is done. And here Rabbeinu Bachya shows his mystical tendencies and says, listen, if this is going to be a mitzvah, it can only be a mitzvah, something which is commanded, a person feels commanded, and that is the person does it for the sake of heaven. And he quotes David, King David in the Psalmist, V'esach ha'pai el mitzvotecha asher hafti, and I shall lift up my hands towards your commandments which I love. A verse in Psalms 119:48. I lift up my hands to the commandments that I love. And lifting up the hands is a notion of kavanah, of intention, of situation, as other verses attest to. Nisal avenu al kapayim. The hands and the heart go together. And therefore the Midrash says, and this is the Midrash Tanchuma, Maken nefesh bishkaga, if someone kills someone else unintentionally, Dafka bishkaga v'loba zadon, it has to be specifically unintentionally, not an accidental act, not an act of commission. That's the case that we're talking about here in our verse. That's the case. For if he killed with intention and says, I actually slaughtered that person, I slayed that person unintentionally, but we know that it was intentional, or we have good reason to believe that's intentional, ein kol tinoto, we don't allow him to seek to have refuge in the ir miklat. There's no, it's not a magic formula that you say I did it unintentionally. It has to be established by court that you did it unintentionally. And therefore, even if such a person runs to the holiest spot in Judaism, runs into the Holy of Holies, holds on to the holy altar, we take, and he indeed has done this great moral trespass of killing another mortal, we take him out of there. We take him kicking and screaming from the holiest spot. There is no sanctuary for someone who kills intentionally. And according to the Torah, it's only, therefore, one who kills unintentionally who goes into exile. And here is an interesting parallel, because we see this by Adam HaRishon, the first human, Adam. The Talmud speaks of this. Zohar quotes the verse which says the verse from Psalms, Zochor rachamecha Hashem v'chasadecha ki me'olam hema. You remember your mercies, O God, and your acts of loving kindness, because they have existed forever or from a long time back. And according to the Midrash, David says, Ribono Shalom, Master of Heaven, you have great mercies, and that comes to this man who has slayed, that you find for him, that you prepare for him a city of refuge, and he is exiled there. Why? Because he did not kill intentionally. He did not kill mazid. Therefore, he's not suitable to die, and therefore, that is the mercies that have gone all the way back. Because indeed, Adam, first Adam, who brought death to every generation, after all, through his sin with Eve, he brought death to all generations. Nonetheless, you had mercy upon him, and you took him into exile out of the garden, into the world. Shneamar, as it says, Veshecheu Hashem Elokim began Eden, God cast them forth from the Garden of Eden. And it says, Veigarish Adam, he drove out man. And therefore we say, oh God, you remember your tender mercies, you remember your acts of loving kindness. And therefore, what I think Rabbeinu Bachya is saying here, which is really important, because he talks about how the person is really innocent, But then he says it's an act of mercy. So what's going on? He says, because there's still some guilt involved. Not the guilt that would lead to an execution, but a guilt that nonetheless leads to an exile. And this, in a sense, becomes the human condition. Just as Adam and Eve were cast forth from the garden for doing an act which unwittingly brought death to the world. They had no idea they were bringing death to the world. Which unwittingly brought death to the world, because by eating from the tree, they became mortal in the sense of finite in their lifetime, the finite lifetime of their children and all descendants. That's what happened to us through our Zadi and Bubby, Adam and Chava, our grandparents, Adam and Eve. So they had done something, but you had mercy upon them because it wasn't intentional. And so therefore this individual who was killed unintentionally, who has also, in a sense, brought death into the world through his unintentional actions, there is an aspect of guilt there, not spelled out exactly by Rabbi Nachman, but of bringing death into the world. And therefore, for this person, God also provides a city of refuge. Not everyone is so easy, even though we saw the tinge in terms of Rabbeinu Bachya, the tinge of guilt. But not everyone is so easy on these individuals. My teacher and my master, my grandfather, the late Menachem Ben Sion Zaks, his classic work, Menachem Sion, the Comforter of Zion, on the Torah, he speaks at length about this. And he is a lot tougher on the individual. He points out regarding this that this Rotzeach, and he compares this Rotzeach, this unintentional manslayer, not so much to Adam, but to Adam's son Cain, who slew Hevel, an act of intention, although one could claim that he didn't know exactly what he was doing. This was the first murder, after all. And he says our parsha really is stained with this notion of the sign of guilt that's upon he who murders another human being, even if he did not do it intentionally. Indeed, it says that even after the death of the high priest, remember I told you, after the death of the high priest, he can return, this unintentional manslayer can return to his home. My grandfather points out that the verse says, Yishuv ha-rotseach el eretz achuzato. The murderer, we'll say manslayer, as the English translation has it. But the word rotseach means murderer as easily as it's translated manslayer. Yishuv ha-rotseach el eretz achuzato. It doesn't say that man shall return to his family possession, meaning the land. It says the murderer shall return, or Eretz Achuzato. The murderer shall return to his family possession. And indeed, the halacha on that, there's a drasha even on that verse. He returns to the land of possession, meaning the family land, but he doesn't return to the specific, in other words, he returns to the general tribal land, but he doesn't return to that personal family land. What does Rashi explain on that? If he was a Nasi, if he was a prince amongst his tribe, or the head of his clan, Rosh Beit Av, he does not return to that service. He does not return to his prominence. In other words, he can return, he can retire, he could work, he could be... He's allowed to be a normal person. But the fact that he was a rotzeach, even though he was a murderer, bishkaga, unintentionally, he cannot return to a position of prominence and a position of leadership. That's off for him. Indeed, he is even, and if he does return to Eretz Achuzato, if he does return to this land, he is still referred to as a rasha, as an evil person. And this indeed is very harsh. Why should it be this way? And there's a notion here that there's no such thing as a purely unintentional act, that there's some guilt that comes with it. There's really three terms, halakhically, to explain my grandfather, three terms that are used halakhically in terms of acts. There's acts that are done bemazed, acts that are done intentionally. You know what you're doing, you decide to do it, you're in full cognizance and you do it. Then there's acts that are done b'shogeg. B'shogeg is, well, you didn't know, it was unintentional, you weren't sure what act would lead to another act. That's shogeg. But there's a third one. The third one is onus. Onus is when you're forced. Onus is a case in which, for example, you yourself are picked up and you're thrown against a frail human, a baby, for example. And the frail person, the baby, the vulnerable person dies. But you were just dies because of your weight. You're picked up, you're thrown against a person, smothering them or crushing them. That's really the classic case of onus. And that classic case of onus, I mean, after all, you have no guilt at all because you are merely a weight. You have no choice. There's really no decision. You really totally have been picked up and you have been objectified. Now, the halacha takes it that far that if someone puts a gun to your head and tells you to do an act, in some cases, the halacha says you should rather die. You should rather die than perform the act. But nonetheless, if you perform that act, the halacha excuses you from the death penalty, even though you should rather give up your life, because you're acting out of coercion. In a certain sense, the halacha sees that even though there may be understood some form of choice, there's no real choice there because you're under coercion. So if you say there's three different things, there's intentionality in one, and there's coercion on the other, there's a personal decision-making on one side. In the case of Maisie, there's a notion of objectification, nullification, really, of your decision-making, which is the case of onus, by force, which is the same term of being raped, is the same term of onus, because, in other words, you're under force. Whatever happens to you, we don't blame the victim. And even if you are picked up and you're thrown, or if someone puts a gun to your head, you've been victimized as well. But what's the case of Shkaga? So we think the Shkaga has some guilt. The Shogeg has acted. You've driven too fast. You went out to go into the woods with your axe. You should have checked that it was on tight enough. God forbid, you didn't want to do anybody harm, but you didn't check. When you swung the axe back, how many times did you look behind you to make sure no one was there? You're driving the car. Did you really calculate the speed? Did you calculate for all different parts? So in the case of Shogeg, yes. In the case of Shogeg, you are not mazed. You're not intentional. But you're not honest. You're not under that type of compulsion. You haven't been objectified. And therefore, there is a terrible situation that takes place in terms of what you've done. Indeed, at the end of the whole section, Grandfather... go back to his words. At the end of the whole section, he quotes the Torah words. V'loti d'mat ta'aretz asher atem yashrim ba, asher ani shachin b'tocha. And you have to be very careful that the land that was not becoming pure, the land that you're going to dwell in, the land which I will dwell in it with you, and how does it become impure? It only becomes impure in one way. It becomes impure through wanton murder. Wanton killing. And the Sifrei, the Rabbinic Midrash on that verse from our same Parsha says, Magira Katuv, the verse instructs us, teaches us, Mashma af b'shogeg, that the land will become impure, unclean, even if the murder that took place was done b'shogeg, unintentionally. Sheshfichat damim metamet et ha'aretz, because the shedding of innocent blood, even if only by shogeg, renders the land impure and it causes the divine presence to depart. And therefore, we've gone really two different, in a sense, two directions. We've gone in the direction, the formal halachic direction. The formal halachic direction, we've seen with Rabbeinu Bachya, that the perpetrator is innocent. His lev, his heart, his consciousness was not there, was not in it. And therefore, he's patur, he is exempt from mita. But Rabbeinu Bachya still hints that there's something, reason why he goes into galut. He's in some sort of case like the first man. He causes death to come to the world unwittingly, but he's still part of that cause, and Rabbeinu Bachya stops. The Menachem Sion says, oh, he has brought death into the world, and death has its consequences. And where was he? And he is not on noose. He's not somebody who was forced to do what he did. He did not have to drive that fast. He didn't have to be listening to the radio or darting his eyes from place to place. He has a part in this. Yes, not the part that he's done intentionally. He doesn't receive the death penalty for what he's done. We don't say blood for blood. We do not say that, but nonetheless, he goes into exile because he has committed an act which shows his moral sloppiness. His lev wasn't there to do the act. We'll speak of Rabbeinu Bachya's term. His heart, his conscience wasn't there to do the act, but neither was his conscience fully there to prevent the act from happening. And that's the case of Shogeg. So what happens, and why particularly this form of punishment? And here, I'd like to take you to the great 19th century Hasidic giant, the Sfat Emet, Ger Rebbe, a little town outside of Warsaw. And Sfat Emet is actually quoting his father, Chidushei Harim. That takes us into the late 19th century, who himself was the Rebbe of Ger. The two rabbis speaking one voice now, we can say. He says, a person who kills, so on this verse, comments, one who slays another human being, even b'shogeg, even unintentionally, mashmita karka mitachal raglav, he as if nullifies the land which is under his feet. And he quotes also a verse, later verse from this parsha, v'la'oretz lo yichapar l'dam asher shofech ba, the land will not be atoned for the blood which is spilled on it. And look at that consideration, that when we speak about a place, and that the land will not be atoned for, he comes to a very interesting observation. Ve'en lo makom bo l'mosha kosh baruch hu. That there's no place, as it were, for this individual in the world of the Holy and Blessed Be He. In other words, the land won't be atoned for, where blood was spilled, then the person who causes the blood to be spilled has no place in the world of God. It's as if this person should disappear, as if this person should be in a spectacular exile of all exiles. Elash Hashem Yitbarach Barav Chasel, but what happened is that the blessed God, in his great mercy, in his great acts of loving kindness, no tein lo makom l'galut shama, he gives him a place to be exiled. In other words, the exile is a refuge. The exile is a place because this person is no longer a citizen. This person has taken himself out of humanity. This person has done the worst possible act. There's no ground beneath his feet. There's no ontological defense of his being once he's killed another human being. But God has taken care of him. Quoting the other great Kabbalistic work, the Sefer Tomer Devorah from the great Moshe Kardavaro of Sfat, who says that this is God's great act of loving kindness, that he gives a place for someone who has killed and destroyed another life. And this is what it means, V'samti l'cha makom, and I shall give you a place in which will be a city of refuge. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, gives him this place, this man who's lost all place, this man who is ontologically, in terms of essence of being, is now a wanderer. There is no place for him. He will give him this type of place. I believe that what the Sfat Emet says here, in a sense, takes us back to Rabbeinu Bachya. Rabbeinu Bachya talks about the first human, and this brings us back to Menachem Sion, who, by implication, brings us back to the first murder of Cain. The first human, Adam, brought death into the world by unwillingly eating from the tree. Cain brought death into the world more intentionally, but he was the first murderer. Did he fully know what he was doing? Both became exiles. Adam became an exile who finally found a measure of comfort. Cain became an exile to show there is no comfort having done this type of act. And this is very deep within Jewish consciousness, this notion of the preciousness of life, how we have to be so careful in everything that we do, how we have to measure our words and measure our actions and measure our responses to enhance life and not to devalue it. I give this Devar Torah a few days after the return of the remains of the what's left of the bodies of two soldiers. And no matter how one feels, about how this took place, whether this was a proper deal, no matter how one feels, whether this was a proper deal or an improper deal, it was a smart way of doing it or not a smart way of doing it. And I have my own feelings. But there are great Jewish values involved here, which could be seen on the other side when they celebrate the return of a murderer of women and children, of defenseless people, and how on the other side the return of this individual is celebrated. My neighborhood, firecrackers and fireworks, we're just celebrating this taking place. And while for us, and we desperately wanted the two to return, and we desperately wanted the return in life, and we received them only in their death, but we desperately wanted them back. We hope that this does not refer to an exile for us in having them back as a return. That the widow will know that she's no longer an aguna, that she's no longer chained to a phantom, but that after time she will, as Israelis do, return to a life. It's too soon to talk about that, but we give her a bracha that she'll return to life. And this country, which is so sad at this moment, a moment returns to life. We needed them back because of how much we value life. We value life so much that we needed them back even in their death. That somehow this land, if we could not have them back, this land in some way would be impure if we did not have them back. And that's the religious reason for why, religious reasons why they came back, despite the realpolitik, which is extraordinarily important, and those moral calculations. On our side, we remind ourselves in these parshiyot, there's a need for a city of refuge. There's a need for even the unintentional slayer to take consciousness of what they have done. Take value of life, that this is a land built on the value of life. That we have, thank God, an army that's built on the value of life. And even when they have to do very, very hard things, they do it because of the value of life. And not, God forbid, the value of death. And that when, if the army needs to do things, or decisions are made, they need to do it because the moral imperative is there that renders us impossible of doing anything else. No one's killed bemazed intentionally in the sense that we want to kill. No one's done bishogeg because of sloppy moral thinking and not being consciousness. If anything, it only becomes a case of onus, a case of being forced into a position that we need to defend ourselves. And these are some of the thoughts that this parsha evokes in me. I hope that the parsha will bring these hard weeks of the 3 weeks will end when they need to, and that they'll end with as we remember those who have been returned to us, remember their lives, that there'll be comfort, that we will be able to return from our city of refuge, that we will be somehow freed from this at the proper time, and that we will continue to do as a people, as a community, that which needs to be done to defend our people, defend the moral values that we extol, and to uphold the Tzom Elokim, the image of the divine, which we believe is the possession of all human beings. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Landes. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send us an email at podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.